If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Were all suspected witches burned at the stake? Was it legal to use torture to gain a confession of practicing magic? And which professions were most commonly accused of dabbling in the dark arts? In today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, historian Professor Owen Davies tackles the history of witchcraft. As always in this series, Owen will be answering a combination of listener questions from social media and the internet's top search engine questions, put to him today by Charlotte Hodgman.
So Owen, thanks ever so much for joining us today. We're going to be talking about the history of witchcraft and witches. So perhaps a good place to start is kind of perhaps you could just kind of define what witchcraft is and was in the past.
Witchcraft is essentially a branch of magic. Fundamentally, it's harmful magic. So witchcraft in a historic context can never be a good thing. A witch in the past can never be a good thing. So it's wide-ranging in terms of what is witchcraft. From a popular perspective, on the ground, so to speak, then witchcraft is mostly what we call maleficium. That is everyday harmful bits of magic and annoyance by a witch in your community who wants to cause you harm, maybe even death, out of envy, out of spite. It can be from anything from making your cartwheel fall off to making your, you know, bewitching your baby or your child, your cows, your pigs, your chickens, making them stop laying eggs. Often quite common in dairying communities, witches would supposedly attack butter making so the butter would never come or the milk would go sour. It's all those sorts of myriad sorts of misfortunes can be explained from the bottom. From the elite point of view, from theological point of view, a witch is essentially complicit with the devil. It's that they are the devil's henchmen and henchwomen, and they are part of the conspiracy to overthrow Christendom. So, you know, on a high-end theology, they are quite different conceptually to what they are on the ground. But then when it comes to the laws against witchcraft that are brought in, then the kind of the two urgencies come together.
Okay, no, thank you for that. That's good to kind of clarify that before we start. So perhaps if we start with some of the kind of most popular Google questions, just to kind of get us underway. Who was the first person to be accused of witchcraft that we know of?
It's impossible to know who the first person accused of being a witch is or being accused of witchcraft. We just don't know. We don't have the records for that. What we can say is that the concept of witchcraft and the witch figure we have, you know, they are talked about in classical sources, ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and even before that, when we look at sort of, you know, the early civilizations, there are clearly people who are accused of performing harmful magic against their neighbors or whatever. So we know that the concept goes back thousands of years, you know, and it depends where you are in the different cultures and different periods. The whole point for us as historians is when they get recognized in the sources. And if we're looking at focusing right back onto a British cases, there are clearly records in Anglo-Saxon records, in medieval records of these witch figures doing harm. But obviously it's with the first laws, explicit laws against witchcraft, the very first one being in 1542, that we actually get really these people being identified. In the medieval period, there are kind of various courtly intrigues that take place where people are sometimes accused of sorcery in particular. But the classic witch figure, really, we only really see them clearly when the laws are introduced.
You've kind of touched on this. When did witchcraft first become a crime?
Depends where you are, of course. But in Europe, and when it is the European witch trials, and then in the colonies of the European countries, there's a range of laws that come in around 1530s, 1540s. So the Holy Roman Empire. We have a Carolina Code that's brought in like 1530s, but then laws in Denmark and other countries which aren't part of the Holy Roman Empire introduce their own laws. So it really is this period of the 1530s, 1540s, and that includes England, Wales and Scotland, where the English law comes in 1542. And, you know, the laws are recognising the fears and concerns, particularly, obviously, of the elite, but obviously they also meet the fears and concerns of people on the ground about maleficium and everyday harmful acts of supposed witchcraft. But once you introduce the law, depending on the legal system that's operating in different countries, then that's obviously when the opportunity comes to, because the state is basically saying, we will deal with these people for you. Before that, you would have to rely on magic or counter magic yourself. And so there's different processes of thinking that go on once the law is introduced.
Okay, so let's move on then to some of, we've had a lot of response actually across social media to kind of our shout out for questions for this interview. So Jack M. Smith on Instagram wanted to know, was there a time or place when witchcraft was respected or revered in society?
No, because witchcraft is inherently considered to be malign, to be bad, to be harmful. So we need to make a distance from contemporary conceptions of witchcraft, neo-pagan witchcraft, Wicca, other various expressions where obviously that is a spiritual, religious, magical practice, or generally benign, environmental and everything else. That is very different to the idea and concept of witch prior to the development of Wicca et al. After the Second World War. So, you know, prior to that, witches are bad, evil. That's it. And that's why people say we must exterminate them, get rid of them.
Another question on Instagram was, why do we think of witches as warty old hags? And when did this depiction become popular?
The old stereotype of, you know, the crooked old woman bent double with a sour face, you know, hook nose, warts, etc., goes back to some of the early print writings about witches in particular. So, you know, the old, you know, hag inverted commas is a trope that you see again back into antiquity. A lot of this stuff you can find elements right back to Roman and Greek sources. But you get depictions in the period of the witch trials fairly early on in the 16th century. You get these depictions in woodcuts of exactly this sort of old crone, you know, the figure that was obviously immortalised in Snow White as well. So the idea of age and facial disfigurement and all those sorts of things, you know, is centuries old. And clearly stereotypes and that stereotyping does have an impact on the ways in which people, when they're trying to find who is the witch in their community who's doing all this harm, it certainly does play out sometimes. But I'd be very clear to people that the stereotype doesn't automatically mean you may look like a witch. It does not mean that you're going to be accused, prosecuted and executed as a witch. There's all sorts of other decision-making that takes place about who is the witch responsible for your individual misfortunes. And it does not always mean that the old woman, widow, elderly, begging is the person who's going to be accused. Sometimes, yes. A lot of the time, no.
Eric Blair on Twitter wanted to know, do we have not a rough idea of people actually believed in witches and witchcraft, or was it more a case of people using witchcraft as a way of, to their own benefit, basically, to kind of persecute somebody that perhaps they didn't like or had a bit of beef with?
Most people who are prosecuted for witchcraft during the witch trials and after were entirely innocent of the crimes. Nearly all of them were probably entirely innocent of the crimes, of things they were said to have done. But we do have to remember that people did practice harmful counter magic of all myriad forms. And we may think about the voodoo doll today, but those whole idea of image magic and sticking pins into pictures and crude little dolls, that happened. People did do it. People did it during the time of the witch trials. So we have to separate two things out here. You know, one is that people, yes, are performing harmful magic. And often harmful magic is actually done against suspected witches. In other words, you're using kind of harmful magic to counter the harmful magic that the witch has put on you, the spells put on you. So yes, people are practicing this. And at the same time, the people who are normally accused of it, witches, you know, in vast majority of cases, we have no evidence they were actually doing that at all. So we have to separate out the two things.
Camarilla on Twitter, I hope I pronounced your name right, is curious, and actually a lot of people have kind of brought this up, are curious about non-European witchcraft and kind of the role of witches and witchcraft in perhaps non-white cultures or not Western cultures.
We see the figure of a witch all over the world in different times and different places. So, you know, clearly there's something quite fundamental about the idea of, you know, the way in which humans try and explain the world around them, that they think and create the notion of these, there are people in your community, whether they're called witches or whatever, but people in your community who, for the same sort of base reasons of spite and vengeance, etc., perform these harmful acts. In a lot of cultures, non-European, we also find that it's mostly women. So there's a very, very strong gendered aspect to this. And obviously most societies, past and present, are patriarchal and misogynistic. And so the issues of gender and, you know, is important across all of this, and the same with stereotyping as well. So yes, we see it in every single continent, these sorts of figures. You have to be a bit careful about doing cross-cultural comparisons to one extent. There are fundamentals which are the same, but the way in which the dynamics play out, say, for example, in witchcraft accusations in India or Africa or South America today, the ways in which accusations are made are socially constructed and culturally constructed. So yes, you know, the similar sort of based similar figures around, but let's not say it's all the same. It's not all the same.
Andrew Harrison on Facebook wanted to know about ways of determining the guilt of a witch. So if we look at kind of Europe, perhaps when we're looking at this.
Well, obviously, the law can define and defines who is guilty, not by through trial. But that's not the only way in which people try to find out. So when you've got laws against witchcraft, going to court is one option. And that, again, how that happens, the dynamics depends on where you are. So on the continent, a lot of the continent operated under Roman law, inquisitorial law, and that doesn't mean it's related to the Inquisition. What it means is that trials take place following evidence gathered by investigating judges. So whether it's in France or some one of the German states or whatever, accusations are made in a community, they get reported to the judges. The judges then go and investigate, they gather evidence, they use torture, and then the trial takes place following the gathering. So that's how it takes place under Roman law. And Roman law still very much dictates quite a lot of law in European countries. Britain, very different. And obviously in colonial America, which was using common law, English common law, so a trial can only take place when someone makes a complaint. A person. The state can't go around creating trials. Someone has to make a complaint, and then it goes through the process of a magistrate, etc. So you can imagine someone who thinks they're bewitched has to think about whether they want to report this to the authorities, go through a trial. It's expensive, takes time. And we have to remember that, in England, for example, it was not a kangaroo court here. A lot of people got off. A lot of people were found not guilty. So you could go to all that expense of trying to get rid of the witch in your community, and at the end, all you are, you end up with is out of pocket and still having to have the supposed witch in your community still. So it's just one of several options. And people would often go to a cunning person to find out who the witch is, and then you would use counter magic against the witch. So cunning folk provide this alternative, in a sense, to the legal ways in which you deal with a witch.
And were cunning folk themselves not at risk of being accused of witchcraft?
Some cunning folk were accused of witchcraft. There's a big misnomer out there, and it's on the full of the internet, that the witch trials are all about wise women being, and midwives being prosecuted. That's nonsense. There is no evidence that was the predominant reason for why people were accused of witchcraft and who were accused of witchcraft. But there are a small percentage of those, more or less, in different countries, different cultures, who were tried for witchcraft, who were cunning folk or wise women. The usual reason for it was that someone would go to a cunning person because they think they're bewitched. The cunning person would say, I know who did this. Here's for a few shillings, I will give you this charm, these herbs, go away. But if it's connected particularly with illness and it doesn't go away, then the person starts thinking, hold on, I've just paid all this money to this cunning person. I'm still feeling bad. I'm still bewitched. Maybe it's the cunning person that's doing this to me. So people, cunning folk do get accused of witchcraft, but normally it's in relationship to the client-patient relationship of someone who thinks they're already bewitched and then comes to have the conviction because the spell doesn't seem to be broken, that they're being bewitched by the cunning person. So that's often one of the reasons.
Tom Banks on Twitter wants to know, did Matthew Hopkins and his ilk really believe they were rooting out witchcraft, or was it more of a cynical money-making scheme? So perhaps you need to start off by explaining who Matthew Hopkins was, I think.
Matthew Hopkins, notorious witchfinder general, and his psychic John Stern are fascinating figures and have had a lot of sort of cultural reach in modern culture. People seem to know about the witchfinder general. And people sometimes think that they were these cynical pair exploiting people's fears at a time when the British Civil Wars are taking place and they were just in it for the money. But if you look at and you read what they published, it's absolutely clear that they were sincere in what they thought they were doing. Essentially, Matthew Hopkins is acting like an inquisitorial judge on the continent. He's assumed, in a sense, this continental role of the investigating judge. And there's no doubt that he sincerely thinks he's got some sort of divine mission to go and exterminate these terrible people, supposedly witches, who are in league with the devil. So, you know, his whole mindset is nothing unusual. I mean, that is there are Cambridge divines and theologians who are saying the same thing and thinking the same thing as Matthew Hopkins does. Just so that Matthew Hopkins gets on his horse with his sidekick and goes and does something about it. Yes, he does. Obviously, he's making a living from it at the same time. But his motivation is clearly, you know, one which he thinks is a sincere mission from God.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about he was sort of working when the sort of Civil War was taking place. Do you see sort of peaks in witchcraft trials or accusations in times of kind of uncertainty in society in general?
You can see some patterns in terms of the rise and fall of witch trials or intensity, and you can try and map them onto times of great instability, such as war or famine. And yes, you can see some correlations, and people have tried to do this with the 30 Years' War on the continent. When you look at the Civil War, British Civil War period in the mid-17th century in England, there is a spike, but you have to be careful, because most of the spike in trials is caused by Matthew Hopkins. In other words, his proactive campaign. And I should say with Matthew Hopkins, he's doing nothing illegal. He doesn't actually try them. What he does, as I say, is like an investigating judge. He goes and questions people, extracts evidence, and hands over to the authorities and say, look, I've got all this evidence, boom. So he's not judge and jury at all in this. But he skews the figures when it comes to, when you look at English, the rise and fall of English trials, he skews just 2 years, really, you know, skews the figures there because of his actions. And if without that, one suspects that there wouldn't be this great spike. In other words, you might call it an aberration, but, you know, it's historical fact. But the peak of the trials in England was actually in the 1590s under Queen Elizabeth. That's where the peak was. You get to the 1620s and it becomes an absolute trickle, 1620s, 1630s. Then suddenly the spike with Matthew Hopkins, and then it all collapses again. People can get a misunderstanding of thinking that certainly in an English context, the intensity is in the mid-17th century, when in fact, let's say, for most of the country, because Matthew Hopkins is largely in the east of England, for most of the country, the peak was in the 1590s. And we see that pattern on the continent as well. There are some states like the Palatinate where the trials are pretty much ended by 1610. You can look at France, where they became a trickle by the mid-17th century. And it all depends on the nature of rulers, nature of the legal system, things like that. But yes, we can. I wouldn't overemphasise the links when you've got famine or war, because fundamentally, again, you've got these two baseline things of misfortune on the ground and the campaign against satanic conspiracy at the top.
Okay. Nicole on Twitter was asking about the role of familiars and whether animals were put to death for being familiars.
No. There's a famous book by Evans, which is about the trial of animals. And from a legalistic point of view, a medieval period, early modern period, or early modern point, I should say, there were a series of trials of animals. And this was very much in a theological framework of accusation and explanation for, you know, various sorts of divine acts. But familiars, and during the witch trials, no, there were no animals prosecuted. That's two separate histories going on. One, the prosecution of animals in the medieval period, and then the witch trials. Yes, there's lots of information, particularly in the English material, about these familiars who were shapeshifted as cats and dogs. During the few years of Matthew Hopkins, we get a wider array of familiars. Even turkey cocks appear, which is obviously an American turkey. But even then, you know, people are going, oh, there's this turkey and it's a familiar. You know, East Anglia, which is quite interesting. But mostly dogs and cats. In other words, pets, you know. And so, you know, there is quite a lot of work being done now on familiars. There's no trial of familiars. There's no law for doing that. And at the same time, no one goes around and can actually catch a familiar either. These are, you know, slippery, spiritual, nasty things. But no one actually says, I've got one which I'll bring to the magistrate, you know.
Edwardian House Dweller on Instagram wanted to know how many men were tried and or executed for witchcraft. Could men be witches, I guess, as well?
During the early modern trials, and again, you know, after the trials, people still believe in witchcraft, and I've looked at those. And roughly across Europe, you're looking at around 20% of all those prosecuted were men.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah. So if you add it up, that's thousands, you know, several thousand men who are executed for under witchcraft laws. And we have to remember that the laws themselves were quite broad. It wasn't just harmful magic. There are other aspects of magic that were also in, like treasure hunting, for example, you know, which came under these broader laws. So, you know, you have to unpick it a bit about what these male witches were doing. Some of them were accused just as women witches were, or accused witches of maleficium. Some were performing treasure hunting, for example. Some might have been conjuring up spirits and other acts. So it's quite broad. But yes, we must always remember that around 20%. And you can go to certain places at certain times and you get actually a majority of those being prosecuted being men. So there's a period in Normandy and France where a series of shepherds get accused of witchcraft. And so for a period, it's actually men who are being accused more than women. And you can look at parts of Nordic countries and you'll see that, you know, Sami magicians are being accused under laws against witchcraft. They're not actually necessarily being accused of maleficium or harmful magic. They're accused under the laws for being Sami magicians. So within that 20%, you can unpick different trends going on different places for different reasons, but all the more fascinating and all the more reason to remember. But at the same time, you know, it is 80% of women being prosecuted and executed.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
There's a notorious case in the town of Elvangen in what's now Germany, where torture ratcheted up to the point at which, you know, nearly half the town was somehow under investigation. And it collapses, the whole thing collapses under its own intrinsic illogicality, in a sense, because one of the wives of one of the judges gets accused, named under torture, and the whole thing collapsed. But by that time, you know, dozens of people have been executed.
Was the belief in witches strengthened by Catholic anxieties towards Protestantism and vice versa?
Fairly early on in the histories of witchcraft, I'm talking about the late 19th, early 20th centuries, and the first sort of histories are being written about the witch trials, there was an argument put forward that somehow this was all about Catholics accusing Protestants and Protestants accusing Catholics. Obviously, the Reformation had happened. And, you know, 1518, 1519. And, you know, very quickly, a number of countries had turned Protestant. From a Catholic perspective, this was seen to be, was explained in terms of being the work of the devil. He's trying to undermine Christendom, as talked about in the Book of Revelation and the Bible. So, you know, from a papal point of view, the Reformation itself is a sign of the devil's work. Whereas from a Protestant point of view, they say we've had to break from the Church of Rome because the papacy is the head of the Pope is essentially the devil's emissary. You know, the papacy has become corrupt. The Church has become corrupt and it's been corrupted. And you can make the associations with that being part of it. So the two are accusing each other here of doing the devil's work and being inspired by Satan. Doesn't actually play out in terms of understanding the trials. And so there was quite a lot of nonsense written early on about saying, well, in Catholic states, they were picking on the Protestants, and Protestant states they were picking up the Catholics, and just using witchcraft as a means of exterminating one or the other. Does not map out at all. Very few. The trials cannot in any way be explained by what we call confessional conflict between Catholics and Protestants. And there are very few trials where there's even any explicit reference to that being any form of motivation. So no, we have to knock that on the head.
Andrew Harrison on Facebook wanted to know, how was guilt determined? So once someone had been accused of witchcraft, what was the process? What happened next?
Determining guilt in a court of law, again, depends on the legal systems. If we want to use common law, which is obviously in operation in England, Wales and Scotland, for example, guilt is determined by jury, trial by jury. And you have two types of jury. You have a petty jury and a grand jury. So what happens is that someone makes an accusation, accuses someone of witchcraft, brings some evidence, you go to the local magistrate, he hears the evidence, witnesses are brought, he takes some testimonies, etc. He decides whether there's enough evidence for it to go to court, to the assizes, which is the highest courts which deal with capital offences. And then it's the magistrate who decides. If it then goes to court, then it's up to initially a grand jury to decide whether there's sufficient evidence. If they decide there's enough evidence, then it goes to the petty jury. In other words, the trial that we're more familiar with of 12 men in a court of law. And then what happens in the actual trial itself is that witnesses are brought. The defendant can't defend themselves. It doesn't happen under the law. And so it's all about the weight of this testimony which the jury has to decide.
What about things like the use of torture to extract confessions and things like that? Was that actually used?
Torture was illegal in witch trials in England. It's obviously used widely on the continent, and a degree of torture is also used in Scotland. But in England, torture was for treason, was used for treason. But it was not allowed. It was illegal to torture a witch for confessions. On the continent, it was widespread. It doesn't matter whether it's Protestant or Catholic or whatever. And the whole reason of confession was the idea that this kind of religious underpinning is that torture is considered to be valid in a sense because you have to make these people confess, because to confess not only in trial but to confess before God. And so there is unjust that you kind of force them to confess to their sins, to their heinousness of the supposed crimes they committed. But of course, torture is one of the key reasons that we have tens of thousands of people prosecuted and executed. Because under torture, people name names. So it spirals and spirals and spirals. So rather than just a pattern of one trial here, one person there, one person here, you know, there might not even be a witch prosecution in England for a year or whatever. When you use torture and people name names, then you literally bring in hundreds of people who are then brought in and tortured and torture and torture and torture. There's a notorious case in the town of Elvangen in what's now Germany, where torture ratcheted up to the point at which, you know, nearly half the town was somehow under investigation, and it collapses. The whole thing collapses under its own intrinsic illogicality, in a sense, because one of the wives of one of the judges gets accused, named under torture, and the whole thing collapsed. But by that time, you know, dozens of people have been executed. So that's what torture can do, you know, in terms of exploding an accusation up from very minor to becoming, you know, a crisis in a sense.
Yeah. Do we see the kind of witch, you say there was a peak in the sort of 1590s, in the Elizabethan period, in witch trials. Do we see this happening elsewhere in the world at a similar time?
I mean, the witch trials are European in scope, obviously. There are witch trials in Russia at the same time, but more diffuse. You get witch scares in different cultures at different times. I mean, there are examples of similar sorts of trials taking place in China, 18th century. So, you know, these patterns take place at different times and different places. Again, sometimes these are dictated by the introduction of laws and the rescinding of laws. Sometimes, if they come from the ground up, it can happen at any time. So, you know, in our contemporary world, there are dozens of women being beaten up and brutally murdered for being witches today. This isn't the state, It's not, in other words, the state is trying to clamp down on these ground up sort of lynch mobs, basically. But these are happening breaking out in different places on a fairly regular basis today, leading to death. So, you know, we can see how these fears about these witches can lead to these outbreaks of what you might call witch hunting, illegal or otherwise.
You mentioned earlier about the fact that the kind of that thought that midwives were sort of targeted is not actually the case. Liv Stewart on Instagram wanted to know, was there sort of a move from being a trusted medicine woman to then becoming a feared witch? And if so, how did that come about? So were people who practiced medicine kind of more likely to be accused of witchcraft?
The link between female healers and witch trials is fairly tenuous. Yes, if you go through all the witch trials, you will find people who practiced a bit of herbal medicine or whatever. You'll find a few midwives, because that was every community had a informal or formal midwives. It's in the whole history of how men dominated the profession later. But, and yes, you know, some cunning women, wise women, were caught up in the trials as well. But that's not the main link. Most of those accused were not petty healers or cunning folk or wise women or midwives. Yeah, most women and men would practice some form of domestic medicine and herbal remedies. But the real, you know, you would go to an expert, you would go to a licensed physician or a cunning person or a folk healer for that sort of, you know, commonly. But those generally aren't the people who are being accused. So it isn't about secret female knowledge of medicine or anything like that. That's not why people are being accused of witchcraft. People are being accused of witchcraft because of misfortune.
Jessica Roberts on Facebook wanted to know, is there any evidence of witchcraft accusations being used as a way of getting rid of undesirables in society?
The cynical use of the laws against witchcraft to get rid of an enemy or a neighbour. Yes, clearly it sometimes does happen. We can see a few examples of the ways in which people level an accusation because of more other reasons, if you see what I mean. In other words, they're going, I'm going to accuse my neighbour of being a witch because, I want to grab their land, or I just can't stand them. Hate these people, so I'm therefore going to accuse them of witch. So, yeah, a small number of trials probably do originate in quite cynical accusations. But the vast majority are not cynical. People, you know, really do think that whatever it is that's, you know, causing the dairy, the butter, you know, the dairy to malfunction, the butter not to come, or bewitching the cows, or making your child ill, or whatever. People sincerely believe that. I mean, it was a perfectly normal way of trying to explain misfortune, everyday misfortune, in a world where even the smallest misfortune can turn, you know, people are living on the poverty line. Any small misfortune just sink you even further. So those are the things that are determining why accusations are made.
Rosemary Gurney on Facebook wanted to know, how did the concept of the demonic pact come to be?
Demonic pact's an interesting one. You can see the notion developing, particularly through the 13th and 14th century. Obviously, about the ways in which some medieval magicians, for example, who were normally clergymen, either by reputation or accusation, were sometimes suspected of having had relationships with the devil through forming some form of pact. But the idea of a physical pact is something that really becomes prominent during the witch trials period from the late 15th century onwards, and obviously becomes central to some of the most lurid examples of accusations of devil worship that particularly and mostly in continental trials. So that's where it seems that the witch trials creates this milieu in which the fear about the devil, and how is the devil going about doing this, and how is he going to infiltrate Christianity? And that's when you get these elaborate notions of physical pacts, whether it's the written pact in blood, the Faustian pact, which people did. People did write letters. They exist. People did write letters in their own blood, mostly men, to the devil. And then obviously the theological notion of the witch was explicitly about a pact. And it could be sealed through sexual acts, for example. You also get the idea that people have signed up to the devil. In other words, not necessarily that they've said, "I will, if you give me health and wealth for 25 years, I will give you my soul." You also even get these notions of covenanting, the idea that you write, that these witches are writing the name in a book that the devil has. So it becomes quite diverse. But the whole nature of it being quite explicitly that a witch is in a diabolic relationship. But again, we have to make clear that on the ground level, yes, the notion that can link between devils and witchcraft is there, but most mundane accusations of witchcraft do not mention the devil. In other words, they're not saying, the neighbour did it to me, she's had a pact with the devil, she's bewitched my chickens. Devil doesn't come into it. It's about you and the suspected witch, who is normally a neighbour or whatever in your village. So the devil kind of is one remove on from the actual concerns of your average person.
We might have touched on this a little bit earlier. Miss Geddens on Instagram wanted to know about acquittals in witchcraft trials. And you mentioned that actually lots of people were acquitted. Do we know how many in terms of, you know, against how many people were sort of prosecuted and found guilty?
I mean, if you look at the totality of English trials, for example, roughly half. You know, it's a lot of people. I say people have the notion that once the, you know, the witch trials get into gear, it's some sort of panic, insane, all these type, you know, calling hysteria or craze doesn't help, because this is all thought out. There's lengthy bureaucratic processes to go through with prosecutions. You know that you in this country you have a jury, trial by jury. On the continent you have panel of investigating judges doing their jobs. The Inquisition is incredibly bureaucratic, and hardly any people are found to be, you know, accused of witchcraft through the inquisitorial system as well. So we have to get away from this notion that, you know, someone just gets hauled off, gets accused, gets hauled off, put in jail and brought before a kangaroo court. You're guilty, off you go, then you get hanged or you're burned or whatever. It's not like that at all, you know. And these trials can, you know, drag on for months, depending on when someone's accused. You know, it's in one sense, it's a very, you know, dull and bureaucratic process. And often the evidence is found insufficient. And obviously increasingly towards the 17th century, as jurisprudence is getting more sophisticated, certain types of evidence, like spectral evidence, is increasingly being thrown out. In other words, someone says, oh, there was a witch sent a spirit to me and she pinched and punched me and made me run backwards. And it's like, well, did anyone else see that? No. So it's just you and this evidence of this spirit that did this. Sorry, that's not acceptable evidence. You know, if two or three people saw it happening, we may consider it. So things like spectral evidence, which are at the fundamentals of the Salem trial, you know, it's about these girls accusing, you know, the witches having pinching and punching them and things like that. That sort of evidence is increasingly being thrown out across Europe at that time.
One thing we haven't covered is how witchcraft was punished. And obviously this varied depending on where you were. And there's a bit of a misconception that witches were burnt in England, which they weren't, were they?
No. I mean, the punishments depend from country to country when it comes to what happens to successfully convicted witches. In England, categorically, only one person was ever burned for witchcraft. That's Mother Lakeland. And the reason she was burned is because she was found guilty of using witchcraft for petty treason. In other words, petty treason is a woman killing her husband. So she was burned because of petty treason and not because of the acts of witchcraft. So in England, the punishment was always hanging. You know, the execution method was always hanging. Elsewhere, burning was common, but in most cases, people were strangled before they were put on the pyre. In other words, rarely were people burned alive, witches burned alive. It wasn't done as a spectacle, but quietly people were, you know, were throttled, or strangled or suffocated before they were put on the fire. You know, there are other punishments like breaking on the wheel, which people might have seen some, you know, Hieronymus Bosch or Breuchel's famous paintings of people being broken on the wheel, which is basically where you are tied to a wheel and you're just beaten to a pulp until you die. But there's all sorts of other execution methods. Beheading by sword takes place. So it's diverse, the human mind, when it comes to torture and execution methods. The human mind, sadistic, is really quite sadistic and inventive.
Yes, and finally, when was the last person killed for witchcraft in England, I guess, or Britain?
The last executions for witchcraft in England take place in the early 1680s in Devon. So 1680s, early 1680s, 1683, that's the last executions for witchcraft, the last successful. The last person to be found guilty is in 1712 in Hertfordshire, Jane Wenham, trial of Jane Wenham. She is the last person to be convicted and sentenced to death as a witch. And huge amounts of evidence was brought by her neighbours and stuff. A lot of it, spectral evidence, was thrown out. By this. And what she's actually convicted for is talking to the devil in the form of a cat. Okay, that's what she's actually found guilty of, not all the maleficium and stuff like that. She's actually reprieved and lives out the rest of her life quite peaceably. But she is the last one to be convicted, and then she's pardoned. On the continent, the last trials take place in Central Europe and Switzerland, 1780s. It's the last trial under Witchcraft Act. Although when you look at the nature of the last Swiss trial, it's actually much more about poisoning than anything else. But in general, across Europe, the trials are really petering out, you know, by the 18th century. And then you get ones here and there, often to do with actually treasure hunting and things like that. But so that the peak is over.
Are there examples of sort of community justice? So communities taking matters into their own hands and not trying a witch, but, you know, punishing or trying to find out whether somebody is a witch.
We get, even during the period of the trials, people would sometimes take the law into their own hands to try and find the guilt of a witch. Famously, people will know about swimming a witch, the idea that it's called the water test, the idea that if you suspect someone, you take her to a pool or a stream, you tie her with ropes and you put her into the water. And if she floats, she's guilty because she's been rejected by God's baptismal waters. And if she sinks, she's innocent, but may drown, you know, that dilemma. So, you know, those quasi, they're not official and the evidence isn't recognised in court, but people did take the law into their own hands during the witch trials. And obviously once the laws are rescinded, say, for example, in England, in Britain, in 1736, after that, we still get examples right through into the early 19th century of communities going out and swimming suspected witches. We have to remember that, you know, people's knowledge of the law sometimes takes decades for people to realise that witches are no longer, you know, witchcraft isn't a crime. You know, the witches are no longer. They're just, if someone says they're a witch or whatever, it's a fraudulent thing. So, but it takes decades. So people even into the early 19th century are still going to a magistrate and going, do something about that damn witch. And the magistrate has to explain, go, sorry, but there's no laws against witchcraft, you know. So it takes a long time for people to understand the nature of the law and the changes. And they expect the state, after two centuries of witch trials, people still expect the state to do something about these damn witches.
That was Owen Davies, who's Professor of History at the University of Hertfordshire. If you want to hear more on the history of witchcraft, then check out our series on the Salem Witch Trials. Search for Salem in your podcast feeds to bring that up. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.